Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. In his first days in office, President Obama halted all prosecutions of Guantanamo detainees and signed the order to close the prison camp within the year. But legal experts say the new administration will face tough questions about what to do with the prisoners who remain and how to conduct U.S. detention policy in the future. We'll talk about his legal options. Let's take note with Greg McNeil, a visiting professor of law at Penn State's Dickinson School of Law. His research focuses on criminal law and procedure, counterterrorism, and national security law. He's consulted with the prosecution team in Guantanamo and co-authored the first book on the trial of Saddam Hussein. Greg McNeil, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Pat. It's good to be back.
On the second day in office, Obama signed an executive order to close the detention camp in Guantanamo Bay within 1 year. Signing that order was the easy part, it seems. How difficult is closing Guantanamo Bay proving to be?
I think all experts agree that this is going to be much more difficult than, as you suggested, signing the order. I joked with my students in class yesterday that it's sort of like signing the order that we're going to go to Mars within a year. But we have a lot of work to do if we plan to get there, and he faces some significant challenges.
It's been said that hard cases make bad law, and figuring out the detention of suspected terrorists was certainly a hard case. But critics have said that the arrangements that were put in place and the legal and political risks that were taken by the Bush administration created a very difficult situation. So I'm wondering if you could sort of capsulize for us what Bush's legacy will be with regard to the law. What did he get right? What did he get wrong?
Sure. That's a huge question. And so the simplest way to summarize the difficult issues for listeners is that first you have to separate the detention issues from the trial issues. And as soon as you do that, what you start to realize is that some people were detained by the Bush administration because they were believed to be dangerous, but would never face a trial. That was their plan from the outset, detained in an analogy to what how prisoners of war would be detained, and then others would be prosecuted. And so 8 years later, we're at the point now where we have a population in Guantanamo where there are probably 35 individuals, maybe 40, who could face trial in a federal court if Obama chooses to do so. Another group in the middle, maybe 35 or 40 more, who both the Bush administration and the Obama administration believes are very dangerous, should not be released, but for a variety of reasons, they don't have the evidence to try them. And then another group that the Bush administration and the Obama administration agreed they want to release, but they can't find a country to take them. That means those people may have been properly detained to begin with, but it's time to let them go. They're no longer considered a threat. So the Obama administration is looking for a place to send them. And so Bush's legacy is he's handed to President Obama a situation or a group of detainees who the answer for each of them is different and the solutions are not easy. They'll require the views are so strident on each side, from the left to the right, and then our international allies have different opinions as well, that there will be no way for President Obama to please everyone. And that's a very difficult position to be in your first 100 days in office.
As many as 800 prisoners have passed through Guantanamo since its inception in 2002. How many today are still there?
There's approximately 220 that are still there. And so that's how I get you to that number of somewhere around 40 who look to be who could face trial in a federal court if President Obama chooses to do that. About 40 who dangerous, but not much you can do with them. And then somewhere between 120 and 140 who have been identified for release or transfer to another country.
In terms of how these remaining detainees are processed, what's at stake here? How important is it that we get it right?
Well, there's quite a bit at stake. So you stated the number at its height, 800, and now down to about 220. Of those that have been released, approximately 10% have gone back to fight against the United States. And then also there's a group who have been released who it was admitted that it was a mistake, and they were improperly detained to begin with. And that's largely because when they were initially captured in Afghanistan, we didn't do the type of screening that the military normally does for them. And so what's at stake is quite a bit if President Obama decides to release the people who've been identified, even those who have been identified by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration as safe to be released. But one of those returns to the battlefield and kills an American, or returns to Al-Qaeda and comes to kill Americans here within the United States. No president wants to have that. Those deaths on their hands. And so that's one of the issues that they have to deal with. The flip side of that is what if he decides to prosecute people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or some of the very serious...
The primary architect of 9/11, supposedly.
That's right. That's right. And he's acquitted for some reason. What then do you do? The acquittal would suggest that he's not guilty on the charges. Is he then released?
And many say an acquittal is a real possibility if he is tried in a federal court. Let's talk about the options that Obama has, because there are four of them: a military commission, a military court-martial, a federal civilian court, and a national security court. Briefly tell us about each of them and which one, or maybe there isn't one answer.
Sure. Let's start with the easiest that everyone can understand: trying someone in a federal court.
And we've done it many times.
We're familiar with that. We've done that before. Did it with the 93 World Trade Center bombers. Charged John Walker Lynn, the American Taliban, in the Eastern District of Virginia, but he signed a plea deal, so he's spending 20 years in jail. And that's a war on terror case. Zacharias Moussaoui and Jose Padilla. So we've had some success with trying individuals in federal court, but there are some significant hurdles when you choose to do that, and we'll talk about that when we get through the taxonomy here of options. Military commissions and courts martial currently exist. There are procedures in place that courts martial would be rather uncontroversial, but would face the same types of challenges you would have in a federal court. Military commissions currently exist, but are criticized for a variety of reasons: for bringing in ex post facto law, allowing hearsay, not providing the same due process protections that an Article III court, a federal court, or a court martial would provide. And then a national security court is a proposal that many are floating that would be a new means by which, and it's unclear what the proponents of these want. Are they looking for a national security court to try individuals? Sort of like a federal court light or a military commission's version 3.0, or are they suggesting a national security court that would handle just the detention issues? We'll hold you, but not adjudicate whether you're guilty or innocent. So it's very complex, the template of options, and each has their proponents and their critics.
And what do you think we're going to end up with?
The likely result is that the review team that President Obama has put in charge is likely going to identify those cases that they can try in federal court. And there's a few that you could do. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, there's enough public evidence on him, not tainted by potential torture or coercive interrogation issues, and not based on intelligence information, that you could try him probably in federal court, although he might start opening the door onto all of the government's other techniques that were used against him, try to seek through the discovery process all of the intelligence information that's against him that could potentially absolve him of wrongdoing. He's not really looking for an acquittal, though. He's looking to wear down the system, just like if Moussaoui had decided to not plead out, he had begun to do in the Eastern District of Virginia. So big hurdles, but there's probably enough public evidence to try someone like that, or one of the individuals like Omar Khadr, an alleged child soldier in Guantanamo, who threw a grenade and killed and is alleged to have killed one U.S. Special Forces soldier and wounded another. So those are easy. Probably get that 35 or 40 group to try those. Need to figure out what the President Obama needs to figure out what he'll do with the others. Those that there's no evidence that can be used in court to try, and those that he wants to release, but nobody will take them. And there's a lot of political reasons not to release them into the U.S.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where they may end up. There's this whole idea of transferring them abroad. And to date, a number have gone to places like Saudi Arabia and to Afghanistan, and a few European countries have expressed some willingness to take these detainees. The other option is to transfer them to U.S. soil. But, of course, we've got legislators in this country saying if you, they're released, not in my district, I guess,
right.
not in my backyard, right. And then to simply release them. So let's start with simply releasing them, because there are at least 20 detainees who have been freed by the federal government, but they remain in detention because we don't know where to take them. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking specifically about the Uyghurs from Western
right.
China.
Yeah, the Uyghurs. I'm
Uyghurs.
Never really sure.
How
I'm never
pronounce
really sure.
It, right.
I think that, but I'll go with Uyghurs because that's how I've been saying it. So the problem with the Uyghurs is they're held up by human rights groups and their attorneys as the boldest case of the most innocent people that are out there. But they're alleged to be Chinese Muslims who trained in Al-Qaeda training camps and other training camps in Afghanistan, but not to fight the U.S., to fight the Chinese. And so the problem that the Obama administration has is that the flip side, the counter argument to this is it's the ideology. Those who believe in jihad who want to fight against the Chinese government will eventually turn their attention to the rest of the world who they are opposed to. So that's one argument. The other challenge that he faces is that his own Treasury Department about 3 days ago designated the terrorist group that trained these Uyghurs, designated that terrorist group and some of its members as terrorists. So you would have individuals that you plan to release into the United States who have received training from individuals that the U.S. government says are terrorists. And so, again, you always run the risk that when you release someone into the United States, that you've released someone who might come back to attack the United States. And that's the situation. That's the political calculation that the president does not want to be in. But go ahead.
So closing the base in a year is going to be extremely difficult. But we don't have a whole lot of time, so I want to move for a minute to what's next, because many say when we close Guantanamo Bay, we only move the problem to another location. And of course, there are U.S. prisons in other countries already. So talk a little bit about that. What's next?
Sure. And I'll try to be very brief. What's next is I think we will see prosecutions in federal court. They'll be very controversial. They will be grandstanding and quite a show for those individuals who Obama chooses to charge in federal court. I also think that they might be left with having to say, listen, the Bush administration left us with a big mess, and we're going to maintain the military commissions, but we're going to clean them up and change some of the rights and protections that we're providing to individuals. And that might be the ugly but best solution that the president can implement.
Greg McNeil is a visiting professor of law at Penn State's Dickinson School of Law. His books, Saddam on Trial, Understanding and Debating the Iraqi High Tribunal, were translated into Arabic and read over the radio to the Iraqi people in an effort to judicial outreach. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Construction starts this summer on a new prison in Center County. The state correctional institution at Benner Township will be built on land near the existing prison at Rockview. What will the new facility be like, and why does the state need more prisons? WPSU's Cynthia Berger talked about that with John Kramer, a professor of crime, law, and justice at Penn State's University Park.
John Kramer, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I wanted to start by talking about your experience in the field of criminal justice. I'm guessing it's a little different from the average academic. You've actually worked as a prison guard and a parole officer.
Yes, I was fortunate enough when I was in graduate school that after a year of graduate school, I thought it would be a great opportunity to go do something a little different and see the field a little bit. So I spent a year at the Ohio Penitentiary working as a counselor/guard, and which was a wonderful experience. And then I worked as a parole officer out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa for a year, which was a wonderful experience as well.
And then I should also say you were executive director of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing for nearly two decades. And people may not be too familiar with what that is. That has really given you an inside understanding of why it is people might end up in prison. Tell us a little more.
Yes, the Sentencing Commission, which is on campus here, was created in 1979 and is composed of 11 commissioners, and I was the executive director. And the responsibility of that commission is to create sentencing guidelines for all judges so that both misdemeanors and felony convictions in the state of Pennsylvania, there is a set of sentencing guidelines which kind of orient the judge to what an appropriate sentence is. And they're advisory. The judge can depart, but it really establishes a standard statewide trying to reduce sentencing disparity. And in some respects, with our conversation today, it'll be interesting to how do we best use prison facilities and where do we put our investment?
Well, speaking of prison facilities, that's what we're here to talk about, the new prison that's going to be constructed starting this summer in Center County. And that's an expression of a nationwide trend, more people going to prison. What are the statistics here in Pennsylvania over the past few decades?
Well, in 1980, there were 8,300 offenders, I think, when I started working as director of the Sentencing Commission. Today, as of March 31st, there was 49,666 offenders in state prison, and the anticipation is that that's going to grow 4% in each of the next 3 years, which will take us to about 56,000 inmates.
So that's a very significant growth. One statistic I heard was something like 21% growth over the last 6 years.
That's exactly right, 21% over the last 6 years. And if you look back over the decades, it's multiples in terms of the increase.
So more people going to prison means we need more prisons. Officials expect that this new state correctional institution at Benner Township will take 3 years to build. It's going to be a medium security prison. It's going to hold 2,000 inmates. And this is just one prison out of a statewide initiative over the next few years to expand the prison system. Tell us about that.
Yes. There are also some things trying to think about how we can reduce the flow of inmates into the prison system. But yes, this is the Department of Corrections is a receiving ground, so they don't have much latitude on who they get. But they've been showing a tremendous growth in this. And one thing I will say and commend the legislature and the governor for is they have continued to try to upgrade the prison system to respond to the growing prison populations by creating these and previously other institutions to reduce the problems of overcrowding, which can be a tremendous management problem. When I worked at the Ohio Penitentiary, there were 4 inmates to a cell. Ended up in a major prison riot in the Ohio Penitentiary. And I think this administration, with this I mean the administration of our correctional system, the governors over the last 20 or 30 years, have all said if we're going to put more people in prison, we are going to provide the resources, the guards, the facilities, the prisons, et cetera, to try to alleviate problems in the management and running of those facilities.
So in the next few years, they're going to add 9,000 beds to the system, and that's a significant cost for the state.
It is. It's about roughly $870 million. We always basically program that it's going to take for every prison you build, it's going to be over the next 20 years about a billion dollar investment in taking care of that facility, running it, et cetera. It cost daily, if you look at inmates, it cost about $4 a day to manage an inmate in terms of clothing and food and whatever, health care. But when you look at it per average with overall facility and creating a facility, it costs $25,000 to $30,000 a year to house that inmate because then you add the guards and the facility, the heat, et cetera, on top of it. So you'll typically see it cost $29,000 to keep an inmate in a prison for a year. The only way you can kind of really save a lot financially is if you can close a prison or keep from building one. And that's really, you have to talk in 1,000 or 2,000 numbers of inmates to control that.
A comparison that's often made is that amount of money could send somebody to college for a year.
Yes, to a very nice college, yeah, by the way.
Yeah. So this new facility in Center County has a couple of interesting features. It's going to be an energy-efficient building, certified according to the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED ratings. And as another cost-saving measure, it's going to be design-built, which means contractors design the buildings as they're being built. I'm just curious, that makes sense in a prison? Is that safe?
Oh, yes, it's safe. And we've built so many prisons now over the last year, it's not as difficult as it was 40 or 50 years ago in building a prison. Then we generally estimated that from the time we decided we needed a prison, that it was going to be at least 5 years from designing to get it set up, to get the land, et cetera, and then to build a facility. This cuts that time frame back, makes the system much more responsive to increasing prison populations. And the cost of that, keeping it green, et cetera, has been very functional. I mean, that I would guess that if we were looking back 10 to 15 years ago at the building of the same facility, we would be increasing the costs tremendously, both and the length of time it would take to get the facility up and running.
And then another cost-saving measure is going to be economies of scale, since this new prison is going to share some functions with the existing prison at Rockview.
Well, there's two things. One is the site selection, the fact that we've got this land up here to build it on. That means there's not a need to try to locate a place and go through all the hassles in local areas. If you were to select a new county and try to buy new space, sometimes you get a lot of resistance. Not as much now with the financial market that we currently have, but it used to be people fought pretty strongly from keeping a prison coming in. Now that we've got the space, it's easy to identify it, and now with the proximity of the institutions, you can move things back and forth, even shift potentially guards from one facility to the next if you need to strengthen some part of the guard force.
And you mentioned another local impact. A lot of times building a prison is a boost to the region's economy. This new prison is expected to bring 650 jobs to the region, construction and then guard jobs.
That's right. It used to be, as I said a few moments ago, it used to be that when you started talking about locating a prison in a town or a county, you had a lot of resistance to it. In the last 10, 15 years, counties have seen this as a way of growing the financial resources of the county, and so they have, in many respects, tried to seek out opportunities for getting a prison in their locality.
You talked about prison riots when you worked in Ohio. I wonder, at the most basic level, with a medium security prison, do residents need to be worried about riots or prison breakouts? What's the record of Pennsylvania's prison system on that front?
Well, I think it's certainly Pennsylvania has had its disturbances. I mean, there's been a few over the years. Nothing in Pennsylvania as severe as we had at the Ohio Penitentiary. We ended up with three inmates killed, and we had two major riots in June and August of 1968. But in general, one of the reasons that Secretary Beard wants to keep the resources commensurate with the numbers of inmates is that you can do a much better job managing and reducing the risk of riots. At the Ohio Penitentiary in 68, we had four inmates to a cell. We had disaster waiting to happen. In fact, it was ironical. A week before that particular riot, I was looking at some material, and I said to a colleague of mine, I said, it looks like the Ohio Penitentiary is ready for a riot, based on some prognosis specialist in corrections had made. And a week later, that riot ensued. And part of that was just the severe overcrowding. It made management of the inmates almost impossible. And so this I think, what Pennsylvania has done has been to say we have these tremendous increases in prison populations, but we are going to continue to invest to make sure that we control that and provide the resources, protect our guard population, which are always at risk. I mean, they're unarmed. They're sitting in a facility, which if a riot breaks out, you go back to the New Mexico riot 20, 30 years ago, and there were, I think, 37 inmates killed and guards killed. So
let's get to the meat of the matter, what's going on here. There hasn't been an increase in crime rate, so why is it that more people are ending up in prison?
That's the $24 million question. there's a number of reasons, but one thing, if you look at the crime rate talks about the reported crime. So we look at the Uniform Crime Report, it talks about reported crimes to the police. We talk about people going to prison, we're talking about the numbers of people who are being convicted. And so if you look at crime rates, they're down, but arrests are up. And particularly, for example, if you looked at arrests for drug offenders, those from 1998 to 2008 went up 17%. Significant proportion of those individuals are incarcerated in prison, state prison. And as a consequence, that I think the numbers, there's just a separation between what the crime rate looks like and what the conviction rates and then the increased severity of penalties by coming out of our 67 counties. The other part of that is parole, how long you spend in prison, and parole issues. So we've had people are spending longer in prison. Parole has been releasing people after they've served a longer proportion of their sentence than they had historically. And there are more people who are going on the street and then are being brought back in. So about 6,000 of the reentries in the last year into the prison system were parolees out on parole being brought back into the prison system for technical violation.
So people like to see their legislators being tough on crime, but this creates this this trend toward needing more prisons and people being in prison longer and the cost. What is Pennsylvania doing to prevent people from ending up in prison? What are some of the initiatives here in the state?
Well, I think there's really two in particular I'd mention. One is goes back into the 90s, which is called a restricted intermediate punishment, a bill passed by Senator Stuart Greenleaf out of Montgomery County. And that particular legislation targeted people who are drug offenders to try to divert them from going to prison and moving them into a treatment program. And that diverted several thousand people a year from entering the incarceration system. More recently, Secretary Beard, Secretary of Corrections, has created what is called the SIP program, which is State Intermediate Punishment, picking up on that concept. And that provides a person can be sent to state prison, and if the judge and the district attorney agree to it, that person would serve about 7 months in prison, but a part of that would be an intensive treatment. Then they would come out under intensive treatment. And basically, it's a way of saying we've got a problem with drugs and the abuse of drugs, and if a person, if we're going to get them back in society and in a safe circumstance where they're not likely to recidivate, we need to deal with the problem, and the problem is drug use.
Well, I wish we could talk more, but we're just about out of time. We've been talking with John Kramer, a professor of crime, law, and justice at Penn State University Park, about Pennsylvania's prison system and the new prison that will break ground this summer in Center County. John Kramer, thanks so much for all the information.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
For Take Note, I'm Cynthia Berger.
This program was produced in the studios of WPSU. If you have a story idea for Take Note, send it to WPSU, 120 Outreach Building, University Park, Pennsylvania, 16802, or email it to wpsu@psu.edu. This has been a presentation of Penn State Public Broadcasting.